short months ago, was on his way to becoming one of Plymouth's foremost citizens. Carver's passing could not have come at a worse time. Just as the settlement was emerging from the horrors of the first winter, it had lost the man on whose judgment and counsel it had come to depend. The pilgrims had hoped to load the Mayflower with goods, but that had been impossible given their sufferings that winter. With half the settlers dead, and only a pile of ballast stones and a few native artifacts to show for an outlay of thousands of pounds, the merchant adventurers might begin to doubt the profitability of the settlement and withdraw further financial support. The new treaty with Massasoit had greatly reduced the threat of Indian attack, but there was still dissent inside the settlement. Billington had recently railed against Standish. There had been angry words from others throughout that terrible winter. In June, Stephen Hopkins's servants Edward Doty and Edward Lester injured each other in a duel and were sentenced to have their heads and feet tied together. There was a desperate and immediate need for strong and steady leadership. Bradford was the natural choice, but he was still laid low by illness. With Isaac Allerton, a 36-year-old widower and former Leidener, serving as his assistant, he agreed to take on the greatest challenge of his life. In addition to Allerton, he had William Brewster, Edward Winslow, and Miles Standish to look to for advice. But as governor, he inevitably came to know the loneliness of being Plymouth's ultimate decision-maker. More than ever before, Bradford, who had left his son in Holland and lost his wife in Provincetown Harbor, was alone. Chapter 7. Thanksgiving. A few weeks after Bradford's election to governor, Edward Winslow and Susanna White showed the rest of the settlement that it was indeed possible to start anew. Susanna had lost her husband, William, on February 21st. Edward had lost his wife, Elizabeth, on March 24th. Just a month and a half later, on May 12th, Edward and Susanna became the first couple in Plymouth to marry. 6 weeks may seem too short a time to grieve, but in the 17th century, it was quite normal for a widow or widower to remarry within 3 months of his or her spouse's death. Children needed to be cared for. Households needed to be maintained. And besides, these were exceptional times. If all the deaths had failed to inure them to grief, it had certainly alerted them to the wondrous necessity of life. In accordance with the laudable custom of the Low Countries, Edward and Susanna were married in a civil ceremony. Bradford, who presided over the union, explained that nowhere in the gospel did it say a minister should be involved in a wedding. In the decades to come, marriages in Plymouth continued to be secular affairs, one of the few vestiges of their time in Holland, to persist in New England. By the beginning of July, Bradford determined that they should send a delegation to visit their new friend Massasoit. They had not, as of yet, had an opportunity to explore the interior of the surrounding countryside, and it was time they made their presence known beyond Plymouth and Cape Cod. They also needed to address an unexpected problem. Ever since establishing diplomatic relations with Massasoit in March, the pilgrims had been beset by a continual stream of Indian visitors, particularly from the village of Nemasket, just 15 miles to the west in modern Middleborough. If they continued to entertain and feed all these guests, they would not have enough food to survive the next winter. They proposed an ingenious solution. They would present Massasoit with a copper chain. If the sachem had a messenger or friend he wanted the pilgrims to entertain, he would give the person the chain, and the pilgrims would happily provide him with food and fellowship. All others, however, would be denied. On July 2nd, Edward Winslow and Stephen Hopkins left the settlement at around 9 a.m. with Squanto as their guide. Besides some gifts for Massasoit, the copper chain and a red cotton horseman's coat, they carried their muskets and a cooked partridge for sustenance. They might have a horseman's coat, but they did not as of yet have any horses. Like the Indians, they must walk the 40 or so miles to Poconoket. They soon came upon a dozen men, women, and children who were returning to Nemasket after gathering lobsters in Plymouth Harbor, one of countless seasonal rituals that kept the Indians constantly on the move. As they conversed with their new companions, the Englishmen learned that to walk across the land in southern New England was to travel in time. All along this narrow, hard-packed trail were circular, foot-deep holes in the ground that had been dug where any remarkable act had occurred. It was each person's responsibility to maintain the holes and to inform fellow travelers of what had once happened at that particular place so that many things of great antiquity are fresh in memory. Winslow and Hopkins began to see that they were traversing a mythic land, where a sense of community extended far into the distant past. "So that as a man traveleth," Winslow wrote, "his journey will be the less tedious by reason of the many historical discourses that will be related unto him." They also began to appreciate why these memory holes were more important than ever before to the native inhabitants of the region. Everywhere they went, they were stunned by the emptiness and desolation of the place. "Thousands of men have lived there," Winslow wrote, "which died in a great plague not long since, and pity it was and is to see so many goodly fields and so well seated, without men to dress and manure the same." With so many dead, the Poconoket's connection to the past was hanging by a thread, a connection that the memory holes and the stories they inspired helped to maintain. At Nemasket, they enjoyed a meal of cornbread, herring roe, and boiled acorns. Squanto suggested that they push on another few miles before nightfall to give themselves enough time to reach Poconoket the next day. Soon after leaving Nemasket, the path joined a narrow, twisting river called the Titicut. Known today as the Taunton River, this waterway flows southwest through modern Bridgewater, Raynham, and Taunton till it widens into a broad tidal estuary at the hilltop city of Fall River before emptying into the dramatic expanse of Mount Hope Bay. In 1621, the Titicut functioned as a kind of Native American highway. Whether by dugout canoe or by foot, the Indians followed the river between Poconoket and Plymouth, and in the years ahead, the Titicut inexorably led the pilgrims to several new settlement sites above Narragansett Bay. But the Titicut was much more than a transportation system. It also provided the Indians with a seasonal source of herring and other fish. Around sunset, Winslow and Hopkins reached a spot on the river where the Indians had built a weir and were harvesting striped bass, and that night they lodged in the open fields. Six Indians decided to continue on with them the next morning. They followed the riverbank for about half a dozen miles until they came to a shallow area where they were told to take off their breeches and wade across the river. They were midstream, with their possessions in their arms, when two Indians appeared on the opposite bank. In the aftermath of the plague, the Narragansetts had taken to raiding Poconoket territory at will, and the two Indians feared that Winslow and Hopkins's group was the enemy. Winslow judged one of the Indians to be at least 60 years old, and despite their age, both men displayed great valor and courage as they ran very swiftly and low in the grass to meet us at the bank with their arrows drawn. On realizing that Winslow and Hopkins were accompanied by some of their Indian friends, the old warriors welcomed us with such food as they had. Winslow later learned that these were the last two survivors of a once thriving village. As the sun reached its height, the traveling became quite hot, and their companions cheerfully offered to carry their guns and extra clothing for them. The grassy fields and open forests were, in Winslow's words, like many places in England. They came upon other Indians along the way, but all proved friendly, and before the day was over they reached Massasoit's village known as Sowams. In the years to come, as the pilgrims began to purchase land from the Poconoket sachem, they spoke of Sowams as the Garden of the Patent, a fertile sweep of land with two rivers providing easy access to Narragansett Bay. As anyone could plainly see, Massasoit was positioned at a place that made Plymouth seem, by comparison, a remote and hilly wasteland. The sachem invited them into his wigwam, where they presented him with the copper chain and horseman's coat. Winslow reported that once the sachem had put the coat on his back and the chain about his neck, he was not a little proud to behold himself and his men also to see their king so bravely attired. Indeed, the Pokanoket sachem appears to have been pleasantly surprised by Winslow's and Hopkins's appearance and readily agreed to all the pilgrims' requests. The sachem gathered his people around him and began to deliver a long and exuberant speech. "Was not the Massasoit commander of the country about him?" he proclaimed. He spoke of the many villages that paid him tribute, and of how those villages would all trade with the pilgrims. With the naming of each place, his men responded with a refrain about Massasoit's power over the village and how the village would be at peace with the English and provide them with furs. This went on until 30 or more settlements had been named. "So that as it was delightful," Winslow wrote, "it was tedious unto us." By this time, Winslow and Hopkins were desperate for something to eat. It had been more than a day since they'd had a decent meal, but the entire village of Soams appeared to be without any food. Massasoit had only recently returned to the village after an extended time away, and his people had not yet had time to procure any fish or fowl. Unlike the Europeans, who relied on large stores of provisions, the Native Americans tended to follow the food wherever it might be seasonally available, whether it be a lobster-laden beach, an inland river fishing weir, or, come fall, a forest full of deer. By arriving unannounced, Winslow and Hopkins had unintentionally placed Massasoit in a difficult and potentially embarrassing situation. He was happy, even ecstatic, to see them, but he had no food to offer. Once he'd completed his speech, Massasoit lit his pipe and encouraged all of them to smoke as he fell to discoursing of England. He said he was now King James his man. As a consequence, the French were no longer welcome in Narragansett Bay. When he learned that the English king had been a widower for more than a year, Massasoit expressed wonder that James had chosen to live without a wife. It was getting late, and it was now clear to the pilgrims that there was nothing for them to eat, so they asked to go to bed. Much to their surprise, the sachem insisted that they share the wigwam's sleeping platform with himself and his wife, they at the one end and we at the other. What's more, two of Massasoit's warriors crowded onto the platform with them. That night, neither Winslow nor Hopkins slept a wink. Not only were they starving, they were kept awake by the Indians' habit of singing themselves to sleep. They also discovered that the dirt floor and reed mats of the wigwam were alive with lice and fleas, even as voracious mosquitoes buzzed around their ears. The next day, several minor sachems made their way to Soams to see the two Englishmen. The increasingly crowded village took on a carnival atmosphere as the sachems and their men entertained themselves with various games of chance, in which painted stones and stiff reeds were used, much like dice and cards, to gamble for each other's furs and knives. Winslow and Hopkins challenged some of them to a shooting contest. Although the Indians declined, they requested that the English demonstrate the accuracy of their muskets. One of them fired a round of small shot at a target, and the natives wondered to see the mark so full of holes. Early that afternoon, Massasoit returned with two large striped bass. The fish were quickly boiled, but since there were more than 40 mouths to feed, the bass did not go far. Meager as it was the first meal Winslow and Hopkins had eaten in 2 nights and a day. Their second night at Soams proved to be as sleepless as the first. Even before sunrise, the two Englishmen decided that they best be on their way. "We much fearing," Winslow wrote, "that if we should stay any longer, we should not be able to recover home for want of strength." Massasoit was both grieved and ashamed that he could no better entertain the pilgrims. But that did not prevent the visit from ending on a most positive note. Squanto, it was decided, would remain at Pokanoket so that he could go from village to village, to establish trading relations for the pilgrims, who had brought necklaces, beads, and other trade goods to exchange with the Indians for furs and corn. It may have been that Massasoit also wanted the chance to speak with the interpreter alone. Until Squanto returned to Plymouth, Tokamahamon would serve as the Englishman's guide. 2 days later, on the night of Saturday, July 7th, after a solid day of rain, Winslow and Hopkins arrived back at Plymouth. They were wet, weary, footsore, and famished, but they had succeeded in strengthening their settlement's ties with Massasoit and the Indians to the west. It would be left to a boy, and a Billington at that, to do the same for the Indians to the east. Back in January, 14-year-old Francis Billington had climbed into a tree near the top of Fort Hill. Looking inland to the west, he claimed he saw a great sea. Like his father, the Billington boy had already developed a reputation as a troublemaker. When the Mayflower had still been at anchor in Provincetown Harbor, he had fired off a musket in his family's cabin that had nearly ignited a barrel of gunpowder that would have destroyed the ship and everyone aboard. Given the boy's past history, no one seemed to take his claim about a large inland sea very seriously. Eventually, however, someone agreed to accompany the teenager on an exploratory trip into the woods. About 2 miles in, they came upon a huge lake that was full of fish and fowl. Even Bradford, who had no great love of the Billington family, had to admit that the lake would be an excellent help to us in time, particularly since it was the source of Town Brook. To this day, the lake, which is close to 5 miles in circumference, is known as the Billington Sea. In late March, Francis's father had berated Miles Standish and narrowly escaped public punishment. Toward the end of July, Francis's older brother, John, got into some trouble of his own. Not long after the return of Winslow and Hopkins, the 16-year-old lost his way in the woods somewhere south of the settlement. For 5 days, he wandered aimlessly, living on nuts, roots, and anything else he could find, until he stumbled on the Indian village of Manomet, some 20 miles from Plymouth. Instead of returning the boy to the English, the Manomet sachem, Canicum, passed him to the Nossets of Cape Cod, the very people who had attacked the pilgrims during the first encounter back in December. The Nossets, led by Sachem Aspinet, were also the ones whose corn pits and graves they had rifled. Massasoit's influence in the region was apparently not as dominant as he had led Winslow and Hopkins to believe. The plagues that had decimated the Poconokets appear to have had less of an impact on the Nossets. Even if Sachem Aspinet was Massasoit's ally, he now commanded a larger number of warriors. By turning the Billington boy over to the Nossets instead of the Poconokets, Canicum made a conscious effort to defer to a neighbor whose relative strength had increased dramatically since the plagues. It may also have been a way for Canicum to express his displeasure with Massasoit's decision to make peace with the pilgrims. With the boy in their possession, the Nossets were able to send an unmistakable message to the English. You stole something of ours, well, now we have something of yours. It took a while for Bradford to discover what had happened to the boy. Eventually, word filtered back from Massasoit that Billington was alive and well and living with the Nossets. The pilgrims had no choice but to return to the scene of the crime. Well aware that they were venturing back into potentially hostile territory, Bradford ordered a party of 10 men, more than half the adult males in the settlement, to set out in the shallop with both Squanto, who had recently returned from his trading mission in the region, and Tokamahamon as guides. Not long after departing from Plymouth, they were socked by a tremendous thunderstorm that forced them to put in at Cummaquid, a shallow harbor near the base of Cape Cod, known today as Barnstable. At dawn the next morning, they found themselves hard aground on the tidal flats. They could see several Indians collecting lobsters, and Squanto and Tokamahamon went to speak with them. The pilgrims were soon introduced to the Indians' sachem, Iano. Still in his 20s, he impressed them as very personable, courteous, and fair-conditioned. At Cumaquid, they encountered disturbing evidence that all was not forgotten on Cape Cod.